on council for us. So please break in with questions or whatever in the middle if you have some. I have to apologize a little bit for this. This is not an area where there's a lot of sort of pedagogical background literature that you can read, partially because it's somewhat unusual for large-scale structure field in that most of the time, like with the CMB or galaxies or, say, weak lensing, people knew it was a good idea to do this well before they had a lot of data. Community, a theoretical community was built up and did a lot of planning kind of work, thinking about the subject, and then they got data to analyze. With the Lemon Alpha Forest, the data, mostly from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, sort of arrived just as people were figuring out that this was a good idea to do, to use. And then the people who work on it have just been desperately trying to catch up with this mountain of Sloan Digital Sky Survey data that we have, basically for the whole history of the field. What is the Lyman Alpha Forest? It just, in the simplest words, is the Lyman Alpha absorption by neutral hydrogen in the intergalactic medium, which we observe in the spectra of high-resolution quasars, and used to probe large-scale structure. This is an outline of my talk, or two talks. First thing I'm going to talk about, just very generally, why do we study large-scale structure, and specifically the Lyman Alpha Forest. Then some Lyman Alpha Forest basics and past, but pretty recent results. Measurement of the power spectrum from data, mostly Sloan Digital Sky Survey data. Interpretation, meaning fitting, using theory and numerical simulations. So once you've measured, just like, say, for the CMB, once you've measured a power spectrum in the data, you compare lots of different models to it to find out which model is correct and which ones are ruled out. We use numerical simulations in this role of the Lyman Alpha Forest. Then cosmology constraints. So particularly, you measure some. The Lyman Alpha Forest implies some constraints, but to really measure the full cosmological model, you put this together with WMAP, CMB constraints, and galaxy clustering constraints to get constraints on the full cosmology. So far, the Lyman Alpha Forest is most useful for relatively things that are sensitive to relatively small-scale power. The primordial power spectrum that's predicted by different inflation models, dark matter properties that affect the small-scale power, like, say, if the dark matter was not cold but warm, massive neutrinos affect the power spectrum. We can constrain all of these better use. The best when you combine the Lyman Alpha Forest with other things. Then I'll talk about baryonic acoustic oscillations and future of the Lyman Alpha Forest. So baryonic acoustic oscillations are a standard co-moving ruler large scale that you can see in large scale structures, so a feature on 100 megaparsec scales, which the length of which you can calibrate with the CMB. And then you can observe at different redshifts with any probe of large-scale structure that allows you to see this 100 megaparsec scale, and use it to probe dark energy, curvature, or anything that affects the background evolution of the universe, and how this ruler looks at the function of redshift. And there's a big survey planned for after SDSS-2, which SDSS-2 is the current running version of the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. This is called BOSS, for Baryon Oscillation Spectroscopic Survey, or something like that. It will be a giant survey which will do this measurement, both with the Lime Mountain Forest and with galaxies, better than the current sonar does. Okay. So one theme throughout the talk, or to keep in mind, is that all of this large-scale structure work, say the CMB or galaxy clustering or Lime Mountain Forest, is pretty similar. The Lime Mountain Forest is just one of this handful of ways that we can obtain massive amounts of large-scale structure data. And sometimes you'll see the words large-scale structure used to mean galaxy clustering specifically, but I think that language arose sort of in the 1980s, when galaxy clustering was the only way to probe large-scale structure. It doesn't really make any sense anymore. I just use large-scale structure to mean any structure that's large. Okay, so I like to start from the beginning to think about what we're trying to do. Of course, we're really just trying to understand the whole universe, but that's not specific enough. And I still like to keep things relatively simple, at least at the origin of my effort, and answer a few simple ancient questions like, how did the universe begin? What's it made of? What rules does its evolution follow? And maybe people don't think about it a lot, but we have two pretty practical choices in how to go about pursuing these questions. One is to just do pure theory, think about things based on the observations we've made, what we know about the universe as it's observed now. Also going out looking at the universe and trying to find more clues, basically to help the theorist people. And this is more what I do. But just as an example of how this is a real practical choice, which I don't really know the answer to, how are we most likely to expand our understanding of dark energy? Will we find some new feature in the acceleration of the universe that will give us clues to what is dark energy? Or will somebody just come up with a theory answer? I don't know, but something to think about. So how does large-scale structure address these questions? So as a practical matter, the universe, for an observer, probably we can say begins with something like inflation. I just say it in this sort of qualified way because I don't want to get into what happened before inflation or anything like that. Just what set the initial conditions for structure formation? Probably something like inflation, although if we will find some other model, that would be fine. There's only a limited number of ways to test the details of the initial conditions for structure formation. One is the amplitude of initial density perturbations on different scales, which we can measure through large-scale structure just by calculating how these perturbations will evolve and comparing them to the observations we made. And that's the main area of this talk. Also, gravity waves or CMB polarization from the early times we could see, and some coarser things like flecks. But there's only a limited number of things we can do, so we should try to do them as well as we can. Other question is, what is the universe made out of, and what rules does it follow? I just mean here that how it's evolving separated from the initial conditions. It has some dark energy and some dark matter, we think. All these are somewhat placeholders for things that we don't understand. Maybe extra dimensions, modified gravity, curvature, neutrino masses. All of these things can affect the large-scale structure of the universe. And there's two main ways you can think about this. One is, if large-scale structure was just painted on to the universe, to space, we could, that would almost be good, because we would know it was fixed, and we would just watch how it evolves and get information about the background homogeneous evolution of the universe that way. But it's not painted on. It does evolve, mostly through gravity. And we can get information from that, too, both about things like the dark matter or neutrino masses, which affect, which are the stuff that's clustering, and so can affect the way that the clustering evolves. And also things like the background evolution affects the way structure evolves, too. For example, large-scale structure freezes with dark energies dominating. So, the key to all of to using large-scale structure to probe the more fundamental physics aspects of the universe is that there's some computable connection to the initial conditions and background evolution of the universe. And that's kind of my definition of large-scale structures, anything that obeys this. So as opposed to, say, gravitationally bound objects, which are mostly small-scale things, which decouple from the background evolution and also are very messy and nonlinear and disconnected from the initial conditions. So the best probe that everyone knows about, of course, is the CMB. This is the WMAP-CMB map. Tells us about density fluctuations at redshift of about 1,000. And it's the best because it's the most easily and perfectly computable, mostly because these fluctuations at this redshift are really still very small. So we can use linear theory. And very little complicated is going on in the universe at this time. So we'd love everything to be like the CMB. And we measure, so in all, one of the common themes is that in all large-scale structure, we have this map of density fluctuations in some form. Typically, we measure some statistics, basically, the first one always being the power spectrum of the fluctuations, telling us how much structure there is as a function of scale. This is the angular scale, and this is power. Which I assume you've heard about already. And these are actually, although this isn't my point in this slide, these are the variant oscillations, which we will be able to see at other redshifts using other probes, although they're much smaller. Here is SDSS galaxy map. This is probing very low redshift. Sort of 0 to 0.3. The Lyman Alpha Forest is, of course, going to be probing the space in between galaxies. That's the intergalactic medium, although it's going to be at higher redshifts, like redshifts of about 2 to 4 is where we have the most data. Again, we have the power spectrum of galaxies. The CMB power spectrum was two-dimensional, power spectrum of a two-dimensional field. This is the power spectrum of a three-dimensional redshift space galaxy from SDSS. Another probe of large scale structure is weak lensing, cosmic shear. This shows the cosmic shear correlation function, which is Fourier transform of the power spectrum, measured by the CFHT legacy survey. And here, to put them all on the same scale, is a figure that Max Tegmark made. This is scale, some kind of wavelength in millions of light years, which doesn't mean anything to me. It corresponds to 22 inverse megaparsecs per meter. But the red here is the CMB. The black is galaxies. The blue point here is clusters. So clusters of galaxies, the biggest bound objects, probe at scale that's about there. This
much entrance is.
Whatever this color is. This is gravitational lensing. And then finally, the Lyapunov forest, which the point here is that this probes smaller scales than everything else. This makes it particularly useful if you want to, say, measure the change in the change in power with scale over a wide range of scales, say the that's predicted by inflation. When you combine the Lyapunov forest on small scales with consequential back on a large scale, you have a long lever arm to do this. Okay, so that was the introduction to large-scale structure. Now I'm going to talk a little more specifically about the Lyapunov forest. This shows two quasar spectra. This is a spectrum at redshift 0.158. This is a spectrum at redshift 3.62. This is the flux coming from the quasar as a function of wavelength. And this has been shifted to the rest frame wavelength scale for the quasar. So we actually observe, say, this radiation here at 4.62 times 1200 angstroms because it's redshifted on its way from the quasar to us. But this is the rest frame of the quasar. So this bump here that you see in both spectra is the Lyman alpha emission line of the quasar. So Lyman alpha is, of course, the ground state, the first excited state transition to neutral hydrogen, which occurs at a wavelength corresponding to 1216 angstroms. An angstrom is 10 to the minus 10 meters. So anyway, this is 1216 angstroms. The low redshifts, then you look here, you see a huge difference between these two spectra. They're pretty similar over here. They're much different here. This is the Lyman alpha forest. This is pretty much what the quasar would look like without the Lyman alpha forest. The reason there isn't any here is just that at low redshift, the universe is not so dense, right? The universe is a factor of 4 cubed, almost, denser at this redshift than this redshift. And that means that the neutral density is just a lot higher, and you see structure much more clearly. Here you would only see the highest density places. So that's one of the reasons we talk about the Lyman alpha forces probing relatively high redshift. The more important reason is that after redshifting by a factor of 4, this wavelength range, which is a UV wavelength range when it's emitted, is actually in the optical wavelength range so that ground-based telescopes and spectrographs can see it. So basically, a typical ground-based spectrograph can see the Lyman alpha forest at a wavelength which corresponds to gas at a redshift around 2 and higher most easily. So here's a sort of cartoony picture of what's going on. You imagine you have a quasar here at redshift 3.7. The light comes to us through the intergalactic medium. This is showing a numerical simulation of the intergalactic medium. So it's a cube, 25 H inverse megaparsecs on the side. This green stuff is showing the neutral hydrogen density. The simulation is done by Ren Yu Chen. So the light comes to us, and it's absorbed by this gas along the line of sight. We take a spectrum of the quasar, and then zooming in on this region, we see all of this structure. This structure is a map of the density along the line of sight. And this here is in the observed wave. So this is 16 times 4.7. Okay, so we have a redshift space map because absorption by gas at redshift Z appears in the observed spectrum at this 1216 angstroms times 1 plus the redshift of the gas. So gas at different redshifts appears at different observed wavelengths. And that's how you, that spectrum is a map. And here I have a simple example of how this works. Say this is the quasar spectrum at the top. This is the quasar at redshift 3. This is its Lyman alpha emission rate. And down here I have wavelength. So this cyan line is always at 1216. This is its Lyman beta emission line, which is 1026 angstroms, so a shorter wavelength. So this is what we would see if we were sitting right next to the quasar and observed it, took a spectrum. This is just the, and if a real quasar spectrum would have more structure than this, but this is just to demonstrate it for us. So the light comes to us, and then it hits some cloud of neutral gas. And this cloud I put at redshift 2.9. So the spectrum by this time has been redshifted a little bit. So the Lyman alpha emission line is somewhat longer than 1216 angstroms. And at 1216 angstroms, the redshift to 1216 angstroms, the absorption by this gas appears. This is Lyman alpha absorption. It happens that you also get some Lyman beta absorption, which appears at 1026 angstroms in the rest frame, which is relevant to how this is. So if you sat behind this gas and took a spectrum, you'd see this. So the light keeps going. Redshift 2.7, there's some more gas. And this emission line's been shifted more. This absorption line is just shifted. Place where the photons are missing is at a different wavelength. And you get some new absorption line. So if you're sitting behind the quasar here, I mean the gas here, you'd see this spectrum. 2.5, these lines have shifted. I've drawn another absorption line. Finally, you get to redshift 2.3. The spectrum has shifted so far that this Lyman alpha absorption by this gas appears here. The thing is, there's already Lyman beta absorption, which has been redshifted up to, it started at 1026 angstroms and redshifted up to 1216 angstroms. And at this point, it starts to be a mixture of Lyman alpha and Lyman beta, which we have no way of telling for sure which is which. And this absorption by gas is much, much different places in the universe. So when we talk about the Lyman alpha forest, we generally just focus on this region, where there's essentially only Lyman alpha absorption. And this is a good sort of one-to-one map between wavelength and spatial coordinates.
Can we correlate like pairs and lines?
Yes.
How well you can do that? Can you distinguish between where the life Lyman beta, because they would be correlated with the Lyman alpha,
You mean pairs of quasars that are near each other?
No, pairs of lines, like a Lyman alpha and a Lyman beta.
Oh. You mean we can measure across power spectrum between this absorption and this absorption.
Right.
And yes, there will be a strong signal of correlation between between this absorption and part of this absorption, the Lyman beta part of that absorption. And that would be a good thing to do. We just haven't gotten enough time to do it.
Another question, how much is it spoiled by do you expect any kind of abundance which does spoil helium?
Well, helium's not a problem because it actually absorbs at shorter wavelengths. But there are other, carbon-4 is actually the biggest. Carbon-4 is rest, basically, I could have drawn a carbon-4 emission line about here. Something like 1,500 angstroms. And that then, just like Lyman alpha can absorb all the way down into the Lyman beta, that can absorb all the way through here. There just is very little of it. The universe, the IBM is predominantly hydrogen and helium. The helium,
if you have helium, which is also a sort of very effective, but could you would simulate like you a kind of run off a peak at a wrong lecture?
Yeah, but it's I forget exactly, it's somewhere down here. It's like 300 angstroms or something.
Okay.
So we're only looking between here and here. So another way to put this, a photon that started, since say helium's 312 angstroms, it might be something like that. A photon that leaves the quasar at 1,000 or 1,200 angstroms, it only gets redshifted, so it will never be absorbed by that helium. A photon that left the quasar, you know, down here, could be absorbed by the helium, but we don't care about that. In principle, it could be more information, but there's all kinds of things would be mixed together. So it's only longer wavelength transitions that are potentially a problem.
Can I ask a question about the identity of these gas bubbles? Are they part of the bound object cluster galaxies themselves? Or are they more likely to be part of the intercluster medium?
Not even. So I have good. Let the crack up this. Here's a two-dimensional plot of the slice of this numerical simulation. You can see if you run a line of sight through here, the colored stuff is like where there would be a galaxy. In this simulation, I think you even have galaxies, so the colored stuff are probably galaxies. You can see if you just run a random line of sight, occasionally you'll hit a galaxy. And maybe at the density that I had on that figure, you could think of those clouds as being the most dense clouds where there are galaxies. Most of the time, though, you're just going to hit some background stuff that's outside of galaxies, but even outside of, it's not even in the inner, whatever, it's not inside a cluster. It's really, and I have, the reason I went all the way to here, is I have this one-dimensional slice now through the density field in this simulation. This shows gas density relative to the mean. So one, the mean density is right here. The red line is density relative to the mean. And the spectrum that you calculate from this simulation is here. And this is with the optical depth normalization, which I would have explained in the previous slide, scale to correspond to different redshifts. But let's just say redshift 3. You see this stuff, and let's say see these sort of smallish but still significant features. They were actually bumps, which are in voids and only just got back, like this one only just got back to the mean density. So this sort of smallish stuff is actually coming from gas that's under the mean density of the universe, where a galaxy is hundreds of times the mean density of the universe. And even like these spikes, you might happen to hit a plate. Occasionally you might hit a galaxy where the density is higher. Even these spikes in this figure, which correspond to like this feature, are only a few times the mean density. So the bottom line is this, and I probably would have said this eventually, this cartoon I drew where there's these discrete clouds which you're hitting, it is only intended to demonstrate how this map occurs. What you really should think of is a sum of many delta functions representing the density field, continuously fluctuating density, which produces then a continuously fluctuating absorption.
That was the reason I asked the question, was because if these quasar photons are passing inside a deep gravitational well due to a galaxy or a cluster, then there'd be some local redshift, or actually a blue shift in that case as well, right before the actual quasar photon could be absorbed and do the force work. So I was wondering if the local redshift was taking into account because it could actually be falling into a gravitational well as it goes through one of those clouds.
It's definitely, and I know because I've calculated, a small effect in the bulk of the structure. In an extreme object, I'm not sure, but one of the bottom lines of some of the rest of the discussion of what's physics, which I would do later, is that the high density objects are the highest density objects, even when the rare case when you hit them, are basically irrelevant because their optical depth. So optical depth is I can put this on. The optical depth for absorption is is proportional to the neutral density, and the absorbed fraction. So when you see some flux from a quasar, the flux you see is the quasar continuum, this, times e to the minus optical depth. And you saw that those typical sort of near and around mean density fluctuations reach optical depths of order 1. These high density regions saturate, so this goes to 0. And then it really doesn't matter whether this is 10 or 100, the line gets sort of logarithmically different in width as you change the optical depth over orders of magnitude once it's large. So when you hit these rare places, you see this saturated, completely absorbed place, which is insensitive to details. And that's good if you want to be connected to the initial conditions and simple cosmology, because those high density places are complicated. So this sort of erases those complicated high density places. On larger scales, though, and sort of near mean density stuff, the gravitational redshift by the structure is
by mean density, do you mean cosmological density?
Yeah. Because most the medium density, in a volume weighted sense, is at this redshift is say 0.5 or something times the mean, right? Because the density field is skewed. There's the high density peaks are high, but they take up a small part of the volume. Most of the volume is actually under the mean density. But it's still, especially at the higher redshift end, dense enough to appear in the spectrum. But what makes this powerful is that it's close enough to the mean density that nothing complicated is happening. It's just evolved adiabatically from the initial conditions. Not perfectly linearly, but not complicated. There hasn't been star formation, yes, which we couldn't simulate accurately. We can simulate simple adiabatic evolution of hydrogen quite well. Okay. So yeah, this is just intended to be a cartoon. That you should really think of this as a continuously fluctuating density field, which produces continuously fluctuating absorption.
And dumping in so many quasars, so you'll be able to form a magnet.
Yes, we would like that. The thing is, and that's a subject of future and even directly ongoing, in the sense that I have a bunch of data right now that I'm trying to do that. In the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, as a system, there's one quasar per square degree. And a degree is about 100 megaparsecs. This, the But that, and then that's only like a delta function probe parsecs. It's not good enough to do any kind of useful map of the transverse structure. I have and in the Sloan, there's 10,000 quasar, high-resolution quasars in the Sloan data right now. I have about 150 pairs that data type are observed with Keck, which are on sort of one megaparsec scales of separation. So we can, with using these, measure the transverse cluster and get extra information about what's going on. I'm working on it, but we haven't published anything. This next generation of Sloan, the goal would be to get in the same surface area 200,000 quasars, so about 20 quasars per square degree. Then we'd have high enough density to actually map out the fully 3D structure, at least on the scale of this baryon acoustic oscillation feature, which the separation is 100 megaparsecs. But you need better than that to actually deep down sort of the random small scale fluctuations. So we'll have 20 per square degree, and that will be good enough to measure this transverse cluster from that scale. Okay. So this is going back to a real high-res spectrum. You see the continuously fluctuating absorption. Also, this is the Lyman Alpha emission line. This is the C4 emission line, and you can see there, if there were a lot of C4 absorption, like as much as that, it would all appear in here. The little bit of absorption that there is probably C4. This is a silicon 4 emission line, and it provides a small background in the forest, which you can see sort of by eye that it's pretty small. We actually measure it and subtract it when we do these high precision power spectrum measurements. Another thing you see is there are some, the continuum isn't perfectly flat. The quasar before was absorbed in this region. But it is smooth on small scales. And that sort of sets the scale of these continuum features, sort of sets the scale where we can measure this Lyman alpha absorption power distinct from the quasar continuum. It limits the scale, how large a scale we can go to. Here is a zoom in on these high-res spectra, just to show. This is almost what you would see if you had a perfect detector, so a perfect spectrum, because Keck, for this purpose, Keck high-res is pretty close to perfect. It has very little noise. The fuzz is the noise. And it has very good resolution. 6 kilometers per second full width at half maximum resolution, which essentially doesn't affect these features at all. If you had better and better resolution, they wouldn't change. The reason they wouldn't change, there's a fundamental limit on the scale of structure and features, which is set by the temperature of the gas, which is about 10,000 Kelvin, which means that the atoms just have random velocities of order 10 kilometers per second. That provides 10,000 kilometers per second Doppler shifts, but just random directions, atom by atom. So the structure you see in a spectrum is smooth on that 10 kilometers per second scale. So there isn't any structure in the real intrinsic absorption below that scale. Especially this one. This is probably one of the best quasar spectra ever taken. And this is essentially the truth for absorption. These correspond to chunks that would be, it's a small fraction of the spectrum. This would be about 25 megaparsecs across the chunk. They give you an idea of these scales. For a typical kind of cosmological model at redshift 3, a co-moving h-inverse megaparsec is about 100 kilometers per second, or 1.8 angstroms. Or in the transverse direction, 0.78 arc units. And these, of course, these depend on cosmology a little bit, but for typical models that fit the data, you can think of this 1 to 100 conversion between megaparsecs and kilometers per second. And even the angstroms, they're qualitatively accurate. So a feature that's like two angstroms, like a tick mark here, that would be roughly a megaparsec. So this is not super tiny structure, but it's relatively small compared to, say, what we think of with cluster and galaxies usually. And what makes this useful for doing cosmology is that we can also simulate. So this shows these simulated spectra from this same simulation cube I've been showing. This is the same 25 megaparsec scale. And you can see that if I fuzz these up a little bit with some noise, it would be hard to tell the difference between them and these real spectra. But it's taking a cosmological model, simulating spectra, and then comparing them to the data, which tells you, does that model work for this observed pole or not? If the powers, you can change the amplitude of the power spectrum in a cosmological model like sigma 8. You make it too high, there'll be too much structure. Make it too low, there won't be enough structure. And of course, then you can change the power spectrum tilt and get different amounts of structure and different scales. And all of this affects the simulations, and you can compare that to the data by running many simulations. So unique capabilities of Glenn Alpha Forest relative to its other large field structure are it's the best probe at intermediate redshifts, meaning between the low redshift stuff like galaxy clusters and weak lensing and the CMB at high redshifts. It's a good probe at redshift 3. And also the best probe of the relatively small scales. Well, they're still relatively linear. And I say relatively because they're not perfectly linear, but they're not. If you can, in principle, probe the same scales with, say, weak lensing, the same physical scales. But weak lensing is sensitive to mass, so it's dominated by these high spikes in the density field on those scales, which are fundamentally disconnected by strong nonlinearities from the initial conditions. And just to complete the analogy with the other observables, so the CMB, you have a map and you measure the power spectrum. The Lyman-Alpha Forest, you have these spectra and you measure the power spectrum. This is the one-dimensional power spectrum, so along lines of sight, for 3,000 Sloan Digital Sky Survey spectra. Well, these points, the many points on large scale, so small k, this is the wave number. The lots of points on a small k in large scale from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey spectra. These points at smaller scales are from these high-res spectra. The Sloan doesn't have as good a resolution, so that limits the scale that you can probe. But there's many fewer. These points come from 8 high-res spectra versus 3,000 Sloan spectra. The colors are different redshift bins. So the lowest line or set of points is redshift 2.2, and it goes up by steps of 0.2 to redshift of 4.2. So we have and the error bars are real statistical error bars. We have a very precise measurement of the evolution of the power with redshift and also the amount of power as a function of scale. Remember, there's a factor of 100 between kilometers per second and locations per megaparsec. So this is about 1 H over megaparsec. This is about 0.1. So this is, when you see the galaxy power spectrum on what are considered roughly linear scales, that's about the largest scale we've coded here. And then we're going down to smaller scales. If you're wondering, why does this evolve backwards? There's more power at high redshift than there is at low redshift. It's just because of this increased, fast increase in the mean density of the universe with increasing redshift, which leads through the transformations that go into the creating the spectrum, mainly this optical depth transformation, leads to effectively a larger bias at high redshift, which reverses the normal order, but in a predictable and simulatable way. And the lines are theory, simulations. The thick lines of the best fit lambda CDM model. The thin lines are our warm dark matter model, which suppresses small scale power and doesn't fit, which I will discuss later probably. Okay, so I assume everyone knows what a power spectrum is. It's just the variance of Fourier modes. We're calculating the power spectrum for delta F, which is the F here is e to the minus tau. So after this continuum is the bracket tau, divided by its mean minus 1. So it's fluctuations around the mean of e to the minus tau. A is always 2 pi over the wavelength of the Fourier modes. Sometimes we'll talk about delta squared, which for 3D, it's a dimensionless version of the power spectrum. For 3D, it's power times k cubed over 2 pi squared. The useful thing about this is that you can integrate it over log k and get the variance. So it's the contribution to the variance per logarithmic interval in k. For a 1D field like Lyman alpha force, this would just be k over pi. That was what would show up here. So specifically, what do we constrain with the Lyman alpha force? On the smallest scales that we probe, sort of 100 kiloparsec scales, we're sensitive to things like warm dark matter, which erase small scale structures. So normally you think of the dark matter as not having any small scale random velocities. Warm dark matter does, at least at early times. And the free streaming of all of these particles erases the structure below some free streaming length, which if that length is long enough, if it's very, you can always have sort of cool dark matter, which free streaming length is not long enough to see the effect on the scales we can probe. But if it's long enough, we can see that power has been erased. And I'll show some examples of simulations of that later. We can also see sources of extra small scale power, like if the dark matter was primordial black holes, which has basically been ruled out now, but for a while the best bound on certain mass ranges of primordial black holes was this bound. They add shot noise to the small scale power, and we could see if that was there by comparing the simulations of it to the data. That's the smallest scale we can probe, where the limit is set basically by this temperature of the gas, which smooths the structure in the spectra. And also there's pressure, the same scale, the same sort of 10 kilometer per second scale corresponds to the gene scale where pressure smooths the structure of the gas. So we can't go much below that very well. The sort of heart of the data, if you remember this power spectrum plot, is 1 megaparsec. Where we get the best constraint on the running of the spectral index This is... I'll say what that is. By putting the line out force measurement on this scale together with this CMB on much larger scales. Also, we can constrain the effect of light neutrinos, but mass neutrinos, which free stream on much longer scales than this warm dark matter where I was talking about, but are only a small fraction of the dark matter. So they suppress the power a little bit on small scales relative to large scales, somewhat like the running spectral index. So we can use the Lyman alpha force plus WMAP in the same way, constrain them. And of course, any model you have, basically, that affects the power on these scales, we could constrain if we can simulate it. In the future, on sort of greater than 10 megaparsec scales, we hope to do this baryon acoustic oscillation measurement. So just to make sure everybody knows,
okay,
this is the linear power spectrum, which is always the key observable in large scale structure, where the power is some amplitude times some k to the some near power law. This is the inflation part. Inflation basically predicts 10 near 1, and maybe some even very small corrections. Then you have some transfer function, which contains the redshift evolution from some very early time and also some k dependence and contains all of the low redshift cosmological parameters. So this is a plot of the power spectrum in a typical CDM model. This is k in h inverse megaparsecs, linear power. So on very large scales, you have this k near 1. Then you get this turnover going to k to the near minus 3 at very small scales. The turnover is the scale that corresponds to modes that enter the horizon at roughly the time of matter radiation equality. Modes that enter during radiation domination don't grow, so they're suppressed relative to the large scale modes. These are the baryon oscillation features, which are much smaller in this mass power spectrum than you see in the CMB, because in the CMB you're looking at baryons directly, where here you're looking at a weighted average of mass and baryons, of CDM and baryons, but the CDM doesn't have the features at the time of at least at the beginning. The baryons can pull the CDM into this feature a little bit, but since there's more CDM, it tends more to suppress the feature in the baryons than vice versa. So it's pretty easy to derive this turnover scale for the transfer function. We know the radiation density, and so for a given matter density, omega matter times h squared, we can calculate the redshift of matter radiation equality, and then the horizon. You can calculate the horizon scale at that time, and doing this, you get that this turnover is 0.01 h inverse megaparsecs times omega matter h squared over 0.15, which the bottom line being that this is one of the most traditional uses of galaxy clustering, is just to measure the turnover scale here and use it then to infer the matter density. But the Lyman alpha force is probably quite a lot smaller scales. And here's another version of Max Tegmark's scale demonstration figure on the same with the same units. This shows the power. This is the CMB. This is the Lyman alpha force down here. This is this red dot is at the center of weight of this SDSS sticker.
Is that the same picture as you just showed of the baryon acoustic oscillation?
I'm not sure that Max plotted exactly the same model that I did, but they both have fit the data, so they're very similar.
It just looks like the three peaks here should be on the CMB side,
which would be wavelengths larger than, let's say, 1,000. Minimum, you have the three peaks on the other side. So would you expect the Doppler peaks to occur in the CMB black points rather than the lighted off red points?
Well, the wiggles are here. This is this, and the black, this, these are, the black points are CMB.
So that would correspond to, let's say, the first peak.
Yeah. The first peak is right there.
And the second peak?
And the second peak is, well, it's easier to see, that's the first peak, that's the second peak. So, and who knows what, right? This is maybe even pre-WCMB.
The reason I'm asking the question is because if you want to come to the higher peaks, let's say 4, 5, 6, 7, it looks like here the Lyman alpha fluorescence is your best tool, as opposed to the CMB, which is on the other side. But that seems like the opposite.
Well, but the CMB is getting, right, Planck, the CMB is getting better and better resolution. We met the experiments all the time. So Planck will probe down into basically all the peaks that are there. The thing is, you don't want to, it's great that the CMB measures them very precisely, but it's really the evolution of that scale with redshift that tells you, say, about dark energy. The dark energy is negligible at the time of the CMB. It's just comparing. So you can calibrate the Ruler-Tai redshift and then watch how it evolves down to redshift 3, where the Lyman alpha force is, down to redshift 0.5, where you can measure with the galaxy cluster. And both, I'll show eventually that both of those are useful. If you want to constrain the equation of state of dark energy combined with curvature of the universe. And you want to map out this, see how big the ruler is at the point of direction. But anyway, yeah. So this just, because I will, we'll put constraints on the running of the spectrum, yes. I have this slide, which this is the inflation part of the power spectrum before the transfer function. You have k to the n, where this n is near 1, and then you may have some running, some change with scale, which reduces it in this way, which makes alpha the n d log k. It's expected in inflation to be very small, like of order 20 to 10 to the minus 3. And this is actually smaller than we really expect to be able to detect. On the other hand, there was some excitement because WMAP measures a value more like minus 0.05, that sort of weak statistical significance, which obviously would be dramatically different than the expectation of inflation. So we can improve that measurement a lot. This shows the effect of massive neutrinos on the linear power spectrum. So I have here the power in the model with one of the normal free neutrinos having a mass of 0.47 eV, which I think I picked to make omega neutrino 0.01. This is the fraction of the critical density in of the universe, which would be in massive neutrinos. This is the ratio of that power in that model to the power in a model with massless neutrinos normalized on large scale. So you see it causes almost 20% suppression in the power on small scales relative to large scales. This is the scales which are well probed by the Lyman alpha force. So you see you actually couldn't tell the difference between this and just a change in the amplitude of power spectrum very well if you had the Lyman alpha force alone. But when you add the CMB or something on larger scales, you start to be able to detect this kind of feature. And we actually, when we do that, get the strongest constraints on this kind of effect of massive neutrinos. If you're wondering why it looks like this, because this is the free streaming scale of these neutrinos. So they aren't clustered on scales smaller than this. There's still lots of power there because the rest of the matter is clustered. This is in contrast to warm dark matter. which is here. This is a plot of the power in a warm dark matter relative to a cold dark matter model. The warm dark matter is supposed to be all of the dark matter. If it had a free streaming length as long as these light but slightly massive neutrinos, essentially all the power would be erased on all smallish scales. And that would be just completely obvious in the data. So we know that can't be. We know that if there's warm dark matter, if all of the dark matter has a free streaming length, the free streaming length has to be relatively small. And it's this Lyman alpha force that puts the tightest bound on this kind of truncation. And there's different, the fundamental thing we constrain is the truncation scale. There's different models for different kinds of warm dark matter particles, which can all produce basically the same free streaming length. Just to show on the same scale these inflation parameters, this black line is just a change of from n of 0.95 to n of 1. And this red line, this here, is an alpha, meaning running the spectral index of minus 0.05, like the central value preferred by WMAP. You can see how putting together the Lyman alpha force on small scales with CMB on large scales is going to put a better constraint on this. This less dramatic minus 0.012 is the value we actually find, and we find consistent with zero when we do this combination. So we improve the constraint from something down here to something much closer to no running. Finally, I have the baryon oscillation measurement is this measurement of the location of these wiggles to make a plot of the power, a ratio plot of the power spectrum here. I've just rescaled K by 2% and then took the ratio of the power spectrum. And it produces this gives you the size of effect on the power spectrum you would find from this sort of scale shift. This is kind of the level we hope to be able to measure to constrain dark energy. We do have to extend the scale that we've measured so far in the Lyman alpha force somewhat larger. And like I was saying before, go to 3D clustering instead of 1D clustering. Because 1D, this is a 3D power spectrum. If you only have 1D power, that's an integral over the 3D power, and the wiggles are smeared out. Okay, so this is, should have convinced you or explained to you what the Lyman alpha force is useful for. It's measuring power on scales smaller than you can measure it in other ways and constraining things that affect that power. So how do we actually do this? Procedure is kind of always the same. You have a universe and you observe it and calculate some statistics of the observable, in this case quasar spectrum, and the power spectrum. And you have some cosmology theory and you do calculations of what you expect to see for the statistics. In this case, we do them through simulations and creating simulated spectra and measuring their power spectrum. And then you compare them and compute some likelihood. And you iterate this process for different cosmology theories for different parameters and find the best fit and the bounds on the parameters. And that's what we do. This Sloan data was a revolution in this field, obviously. These were the measurements before Sloan data, where we had 3,000 spectra. There was one in 1999 with 19. I had one in 2008, higher spectra. And then 30 and 23, so about 50, and then 27. Now we have 3,000 spectra. Well, this measurement was published in 2006. There's actually now in the Sloan database more than 11,000 quasars, which we just haven't gotten around to finishing the analysis of. This shows the redshift distribution of the quasars, of these 3,000 quasars is the red dotted line. There's some funny selection function in hard to find quasars that have certain redshifts. That doesn't matter for this because we're just using them as background light sources. The black is the distribution of pixels in the forest, which is really more important to know. If there's 1.4 million pixels, so this is a huge data set. Peaks at low redshift, just because there's more quasars at low redshift. The Sloan spectrograph makes it impossible to see Lyman Alpha at shorter wavelengths than corresponds to about 2.1 redshift. At high redshift, you just don't have very many quasars. So it's this 2 to 4 range where you have most of the data. And if you want to read about this, we have papers, SDSS papers, on measuring the flux power from the data, inferring the linear theory power, so the model power using simulations, comparing to that, physical effects, and then had a couple of cosmological parameter papers where we combine these results with other things. The most recent one being this subject, Lozar and McDonald. If you want to use the bounds, I have a chi-squared code, which basically you input the linear theory power at 3, and it gives you a line of course chi-squared. You can download it, or anyone can download it. Anjay Slosar actually has a patch for CosmoMC, which is the code people use to do the Markov chain Monte Carlo parameter constraints, combining lots of different data sets. Lots of people use this. I have a reference for that somewhere. So the Sloan data has resolution 160 kilometers per second, full width half maximum, pixel size 70 kilometers per second. We use spectra with signal to noise greater than 1. Where the typical signal to noise per pixel is about 4. This one here, that this is a Sloan. So I've been showing a lot of high-res spectra. This is an actual Sloan spectra, but it's still one of the better ones. So this has less noise than most Sloan spectra. One thing I haven't said, I think, is a typical, a line of sight from Lyman Alpha to Lyman Beta, where we use the forest, probes a total of about 400 megachambers megaparsecs. So each one of these 3,000 spectra, so a 400 megaparsec chunk. The conversions from velocity to wavelength, redshift to spatial distances are simple because the separations are always small. So these are good approximations to say that the velocity difference is C delta lambda over lambda, or C delta V over 1 plus C, or the Hubble parameter at that redshift divided by 1 plus C times the co-moving distance. So this is just the usual Hubble law with this because X is co-moving. When I say, I don't know if everybody's familiar with how spectrographs work, when I say full width of half maximum of 160 kilometers per second, it means that the detector effectively smooths the intrinsic spectrum from the quasar with the Gaussian of this width. The noise is primarily due to a limited number of photons that we're receiving from the quasar. So there's just Poisson counting error on the photons. And part of this noise comes from the fact that there's sky, just background light from the sky mixed in with the quasar, which is actually, they're really kicking these quasars. How there's as much sky flux coming into the Sloan spectrograph fibers as there is quasar flux, and that has to be subtracted. this is a blow-up of the Lyman Alpha forest for one of these Sloan spectra. And this is actually, this is zoomed in more on a 40 megaparsec chunk. So this is the largest scale that we actually used for this measurement. So a sine wave this large, period this large, it's the largest scale where we quote the power spectrum. So this gives you an idea of what we're really measuring from these Sloan spectra. But you should remember, this is what is really going on. These are the high-res spectra, not on exactly the same scale, but these are 25 megaparsec chunks. The difference between this and this is primarily this limited resolution and then some noise. So you can see, you can measure small-scale structure much better in the high-res spectra, obviously, or at all in the high-res spectra. On larger scales, though, they would be the same, because the resolution smoothing conserves flux, and the noise averages to zero. So on large scales, they're the same. And the low resolution of the Sloan data doesn't hurt you. So I basically already said all this. Measuring fluctuations in either minus optical depth around its beam. If you just take a simple Fourier transform of the data and calculate the power spectrum, what you'll get is the flux power you want, plus some background, which might come from metal absorption, like we see before. Then power, so smoothing in real space is equivalent to multiplying by some kernel in Fourier space. So the power is suppressed by some factor. I suspect you learned about the same thing in the context of the CMB, where the beam, they call it the beam of the experiment, which suppresses power on small scales, and then you have some noise power. Yep. So the background in the CMB case is called the foreground. And you do all the same kind of data analysis to finally measure the power spectrum you want given the data you have. Take out all the bad effects. Here's figure just showing the fraction of errors on this power spectrum measurement from these data. You have less than 5% errors. The lines are just the fractional errors on all of these points, down to sort of 3%. There's about 100 points. This is equivalent to an overall amplitude measurement of about 0.6%, and a logarithmic slope measurement of 0.006%. Or 0.06. But my finger, this is the flux power spectrum, which is not directly convertible into constraints on the linear power without the simulations, which have nuisance parameters which degrade your ability to measure to infer the linear power. And I have figures of the noise power. I think this stuff's going to be on the web, so if you're interested in details of the data analysis, you could look at them. Part of the difficulty in this kind of thing is just understanding the data, understanding exactly how much noise there is, calculating the error bars on the measurement. So we do the error bars by bootstrap resampling, which you can read about in numerical recipes. We need to do this because the field is not perfectly Gaussian. The field's Gaussian, like the CMD. You can just calculate the errors analytically. It's not far from Gaussian, though, because the errors from this bootstrap resampling are pretty similar to what you get if you calculate if you assume it was Gaussian. Errors aren't very correlated if we had to measure the resolution of the spectrograph in order to deconvolve it. This shows, we measure power in the forest for the mean measurement. We also measure the power in different regions of the quasar spectra outside, so at longer wavelengths than the Lyman Alpha emission, to measure how much background there is, so how much C4 power there is, which you can measure independent of Lyman Alpha here, but would also be present in the forest. This shows how much Lyman alpha power. These lines are the Lyman alpha power that I've been showing before, but now I've expanded this axis. This is the power that we've measured over here. So it's much less than the actual Lyman alpha power. It's enough, though, that we actually do, since these arrows are small, we actually do want to subtract that to avoid getting any contribution from metals. Sort of at the level of the one sigma errors. Okay, so we've observed the power spectrum, or we've observed the quasars and computed the power spectrum from them. Now we need to prepare them for model predictions. So that's the simulation part of this figure. This 2D plot of a 2D slice of the simulation, which shows what we're looking at if we could see it correctly. So this is the basic model for the gas in the IGM, the physics of the gas. The neutral hydrogen density is determined by ionization balance between the recombination of electrons and protons and ionization of neutral gas by UV photons. There's a background of UV photons. And so this is the ionization equilibrium equation, where NP is the proton density, NE is the electron density, alpha is the recombination coefficient, which sets the rate that they recombine. And then here you have the neutral hydrogen density times the ionization rate. The ionization rate is set by the strength of the ionizing background. And it comes out to be about 10 to the minus 4 years. So it takes a neutral atom will be ionized. It will take 10 to 4 years to ionize it. One important thing here is this is a very short time, which means that this ionization equilibrium is they are in equilibrium. If some shock or something kicks them out of equilibrium, they can get back very quickly. So the typical, and it's the gas is almost completely ionized. Almost, so the neutral density is a very low fraction, like 10 to the minus 6 of the total. We knew this, we've known this for decades, that because if you just take the mean density of the universe at that redshift, make it all neutral, you would see no transmission in the forest. This is called the Gren-Peterson trough. You would see, no flux at all from the quasar in this region. If the universe was completely neutral. It has to be only neutral at this 10 to the minus 6 level to see the sort of order unity optical depth fluctuations that we actually see.
Shouldn't that also be a function of redshift?
It is, certainly. That's why, so whenever I show one of these figures of, like this, of simulated spectra at redshift 2, redshift 3, redshift 4, and the same thing happens with the observations. You see the redshift 4 version has a lot more absorption than the redshift 2. And that is primarily just because of this equation, the way that the mean density evolves and how it enters this equation. So the electron, right, it's almost completely ionized. So the electron density is proportional and almost roughly equal to the baryon density. The proton density is also proportional to the baryon density. Both of those are going up with redshift, like 1 plus EQ. So this left-hand side here, just from the background evolution of the universe, is going up by 1 plus e to the 6th. Meaning, for a fixed ionizing background, the neutral density will be going up very quickly, and therefore the optical depth will be going up very quickly. The ionizing background is actually going down a little bit as you go up in redshift, which I guess actually makes that effect even larger. But it's not going down nearly as fast as 1 plus e to the 6. So the dominant effect in just the mean level of absorption is just this mean change in mean density of the universe. So 10 to the minus 6 is just a typical number. It certainly evolves with redshift. So the recombination coefficient here depends a little bit on gas temperature, but that's less important. So why are the baryons a good tracer of the dark matter and also the initial conditions? The bottom line is just that on scales larger than about 100 kiloparsecs, where pressure can act, and that's set by the 10,000 Kelvin temperature of the gas, the only force is gravity. So baryons and dark matter do the same thing. So on large scales, the baryons, and therefore through this ionization equilibrium equation, the neutral density. So remember, it's almost all ionized, so proton density, electron density are both proportional to the baryon density. So right there you have the neutral density is proportional to baryon density squared. And this includes both the mean, change in mean baryon density, but also fluctuation in baryon density. You have some weak temperature dependence. And if this ionization background is constant, which it nearly is, so you have this, I skipped over, but the recombination coefficient goes like temperature to 0.7. Temperature, it turns out, goes like, I'll show on the next slide, is roughly a power law in density. So, in baryon density. So, if you have a baryon density squared times some power law, which is, and so you get some power law of the neutral density in the baryon density, or the total mass density on relatively large scales because the baryons trace the mass. So this 2 is the 2 from here, and the 0.7 gamma minus 1. Gamma minus 1 is the power law index of the temperature, the relation between temperature and density, which is typically going to be about 0.5. So this is like 2 minus 0.35 or 1.7. So neutral density goes roughly like baryon density to the point to the 1.7, or total density to the 1.7. This shows from simulations the temperature density relation. So this is lots of points in the simulation. This is the temperature, and this is the density relative to the mean. So this is the mean density. And this simulation was an old one, which was actually somewhat colder than the real universe. But this doesn't look like perfect power law in this figure, but it turns out essentially all the points are in this tail, right? Remember, most of the volume of the universe is below the mean density. This is log, so zero here is the mean density. Almost all the points in this figure are actually in this inner power law tail. And that the power law is set because the temperature itself is set by equilibrium, by a balance between photon ionization heating, which means you have these neutral atoms, photons come along and ionize them but those photons typically have more energy than they need to ionize them, so the electron comes off with some extra energy. It then recombines later to keep the ionization equilibrium balance, but this you gain some extra heat. At the same time, the structure is expanding, so you just get adiabatic cooling like any expanding gas, and it leads to this kind of power. That calculation leads to this kind of power law. The deviations come from, they come at high density where you may have shocks where, say, where two, say, streams of gas slam together at greater than their sound speed, and some of the kinetic energy is converted to high temperatures. Or also at very high density, you can get cooling, and here you're into actual galaxies, and everything's complicated. But most of the Lyman Alpha forest is in this simple regime. And that brings me to this figure from the simulation, which is going to show how we create these spectra. The point mostly of showing how we create the spectra being to sort of explain the physics that goes into what we see. So this is the gas density relative to E on the line of sight through the spectrum. This is the velocity. So I have completely not talked about peculiar velocities of the gas, which are important because this redshift space mapping of the density field to wavelength in the spectra is only perfect if all the gas is expanding with the Hubble flow. Peculiar velocities lead to extra Doppler shifts relative to that Hubble expansion. And you see here the peculiar velocities can be of order 100 kilometers per second, which is significant relative to, say, the scale of the thermal broadening, which is 10 kilometers per second, and also the resolution, say, of the Sloan spectrograph. Plus, these can be coherent over very large scales, which should be means that the effects can show up at very large scales. So this shows the velocity field associated with this density field. You can see that these are positive velocities over here. This is a high density place. This stuff's falling into there. This stuff, on average, is falling the other way into the high density place. And this is going to cause Doppler shifts, which shift the location of these features in the spectra. Here's the temperature field from this same simulation. And this shows how tightly connected the temperature is to the density. Remember, it said it's approximately a power law. The red is the actual temperatures you calculate in the simulation, including shocks and of gas and even galaxy formation. Winds from galaxies and things that Randy Jenner has included in these simulations. The red is the temperature you calculate. The green is what you get from just taking the best fit power law to of temperature and density. So over most of the structure, you can barely tell the difference between the power law and the truth of the simulation. You get the biggest deviations in high density places where there's probably shocks that boost the temperature relative in the actual simulation relative to what you project in this power law. The point here, so we actually run the simulation, so we don't have to assume the power law. The point is just to explain how simple the physics of this gas is. It's really just expanding adiabatically, heated by this ionizing background, which means that the results are still tightly connected to the initial condition. So we have this density, temperature, velocity field. We can calculate the neutral density using ionization equilibrium, or even this in the simulation, they can follow out of equilibrium neutral density. Again, the red is the what they actually calculate for the neutral density. The green is what you get from assuming the neutral density is a power law in varying density. You can see they agree very well again. Here I have applied these Doppler shifts to peculiar velocities, and I am going to stop now. So you can see how big of an effect they have. This structure had infalling peculiar velocities, so it actually crunched down. When this stuff was falling this way, so it was shifted in the spectrum, falling that way, so it was shifted crunched down to a sort of smaller thing. This thing here moved over here because it was falling. This stuff didn't move as much. Things always tend to fall into density heaps, so there's a general sharpening of features. Here I've applied this thermal broadening, the random motions of the atoms, which is also, they're also particular velocities, Doppler shifts in the same way, but since they're just random locally, and they're of order 10 kilometers per second, they just smooth them. So they smoothed out some of the sharpness that we had here. You have less small scale structure. And finally, that was optical depth. Finally, you take e to the minus optical depth to get to the spectrum. And the normalization of the optical depth depends on redshift because of these evolution of the mean density and also evolution of the ionizing background effect. One thing, so again, the red is the direct simulation result. The green is assuming this power law temperature density relation. One important thing you see here is these saturated regions, these highest density regions, which are the most complicated and the most difficult to simulate, tend to just have a large enough optical depth that you see zero. And the optical depth could be different by a factor of two, you would still just see zero. So we're not sensitive to high density places, which are complicated. We see these features here that are remarkably just bumps in a void, which have only just barely gotten, or not at all, gotten back to the mean density of the universe. So this is under dense structure. And I guess I'll stop there for today.